is Common Sense Radio. Straightforward and no excuses.
All right. Come on now.
This is the Steve Gruber Show.
Call me crazy.
Ooh, yeah.
What I said was perfectly right and spot on accurate.
Boy's got a mouth like a cannon, always shooting it all.
Stop. Yeah, stop. I mean, you're way off script.
Got it in me. Gonna quit until it all comes out.
Hey, boy.
Yeah, you know, it's not cynical, it's common sense.
Pay attention to me when I'm talking to you.
I'm gonna rock the nation.
Genuine, accountable, and raw. Here is Steve Gruber.
All right, and welcome to it. It is 6 after on this Tuesday. Hope your weekend was enjoyable. I hope you took time to remember exactly why we have Memorial Day weekend. Some gave it all so that we could be here today. And that's the key here. Breaking news this day. Mike Dubke, the president's communications director, leaving the White House after just a few months. The start of a wave of changes as the West Wing struggles to get a handle on its messaging. Dubke serving for 3 months before tendering his resignation May 18th. He offered to stay through the overseas trip. Trump accepted. He's been trying to help restructure the press and communications operation and is parting on good terms. Dubke came in with few patrons, never was able to get a team together or get the support he needed. Dubke still coming into work. His last day has not been set. His job is likely to remain open for a bit. Trump is considering much broader changes, including the possibility of bringing in David Urban, a prominent GOP lobbyist who was a senior advisor on his campaign as chief of staff, we are told. I've told you for 2 weeks that Reince Priebus is gone. Good sources telling me that Reince Priebus is gone. It's just a matter of time. Of course, this would bring the criticism of more military people around him. Urban, who is credited with helping Trump win his big state of Pennsylvania, brings seasoned political judgment, no personal agenda. He's a West Point grad, has a master's in government administration from Penn and a law degree from Temple. Urban was on Trump's plane and in his green rooms during frequent campaign stops in the Keystone State, and the two became cell phone buddies. Other stories circulating that Trump met with two top officials from his campaign, Corey Lewandowski and David Bossie, about joining the crisis communications war room he's setting up, perhaps as part of an outside-inside duet. This is all part of an Axios News print-up that just came out moments ago. These are not polished characters being brought in, though Urban at least has Capitol Hill connections. They are killers. And Lewandowski in particular makes conventional folks in the White House very nervous. Experience suggests he will not only indulge Trump's most combative instincts, but goad them. Trump loves the word killers, we are told. So here are the changes that are planned for White House messaging. Sean Spicer will stay as press secretary, but do almost no on-camera briefings. I think that Sean Spicer still does not make the six-month mark. That's my bet. On the over-under, Sean Spicer is on the under. More briefings will be on record but off camera. Trump likely to travel a lot more, at least once a week. Trump taking fewer questions from the press when he's on the road. We'll take more questions when he's appearing at photo ops with foreign leaders. And the reason being is he says things exactly the way he wants them to be said. And the translation, I guess, is when he says that he can't be second-guessed by his staff. Let's go to the hotline. Matt checking in. Matt, what's on your mind?
Well, these courts are blocking Trump from implementing his immigration policy because he said that he wanted to ban all Muslims on the campaign trail, right?
He said something to that effect, yes.
Okay, yeah. He also said something similar, that he wanted to kick out all illegal immigrants that were in the country. So if he started deporting more people than they want, would they go back and say that's racism and he can't deport them? How far are we going to go with this?
Well, you know, it's as far as the radical courts will let it go. Yeah, as far as the radical, because as you realize, anything that he does can be stopped by one you know, one activist judge anywhere, certainly on the West Coast of America. Thanks for checking in, Matt. And his agenda can be shut down. And we can watch a news media go into a frenzy over just about anything. I mean, this whole Jared Kushner thing means nothing. In fact, now new reports are suggesting that Jared Kushner didn't even ask for any sort of communication with Russia, that it was put forth by Sergey Kislyak, not Jared Kushner, meaning this frenzy is overblown again. Doesn't surprise anyone, does it, that the frenzy is completely overblown again, completely, I don't know, completely at odds with what the truth is, all right? So there you go. Meanwhile, I want to point your attention to Texas, where Sanctuary City's protesters tried to shut down the government of Texas yesterday for a period of time. Governor Greg Abbott there set down a new law cracking down on sanctuary cities recently, but the mob has basically moved in trying to stop what's going on in Texas. It was brought under control, but this is more and more what we're seeing. They think the mob rules. In fact, I would like to share with you, though, something that was said by John Kennedy back on the 30th of September, 1962. President Kennedy at that time blasted the governor of Mississippi for defying the law and the decision of the courts. But where are those liberals today? Because are we a nation of laws or a nation of men? When it comes to defying the law, here's what John Kennedy had to say many years ago. Go.
For our nation is founded on the principle that observance of the law is the eternal safeguard of liberty, and defiance of the law is the surest road to tyranny. The law which we obey includes the final rulings of the courts, as well as the enactment of our legislative bodies. Even among law-abiding men, few laws are universally loved, but they are uniformly respected and not resisted. Americans are free, in short, to disagree with the law, but not to disobey it. For in a government of laws and not of men, no man, however prominent or powerful, and no mob, however unruly or boisterous, is entitled to defy a court of law. If this country should ever reach the point where any man or group of men, by force or threat of force, could long deny the commands of our court and our Constitution, then no law would stand free from doubt. No judge would be sure of his writ, and no citizen would be safe from his neighbors.
You see, the mob can't rule. John Kennedy knew that. You can't just have people deciding what laws are going to follow, which ones they are not. That particular year, the president federalized the National Guard of Mississippi to get done what needed to be done by the law. But the president has not signed any new laws. The legislature has not send any new laws. He is merely enforcing the laws on the books from past sessions of Congress, from past presidents and their signatures. At least John Kennedy got. Of course, John Kennedy would not be welcome in the Democratic Party today. It's 14 after. You're listening to The Steve Gruber Show.
Taking a closer look at the stories that affect you most with a big dose of common sense.
I gotta lose me to find you. I gotta give up all I have. To find you, I'd suffer anything and be glad.
All right, welcome back to it. It depends on who you ask. It depends on who you ask when you look at Colorado as far as the legalization of recreational marijuana. Some say there has been a spike in traffic accidents and fatalities in Colorado, but is it directly related to the increased use of THC? There's no cause and effect direct, you know, straight line, but some would say, listen, this is the only thing that's changed. The number of fatalities and injuries has increased dramatically. Some people say it's been a surge for money. I don't know. But it's going to be on the ballot in Michigan someday soon, because Michigan seems to be a lot more accepting. In fact, a new poll from the Marketing Resources Group shows statewide support has risen from 41% in 2013 to 58% in the most recent poll. Tom Shields, president and founder of Marketing Resource Group, joins me on the program. Tom, welcome to it.
Good morning, Steve. Good to be here.
Despite a lot of mixed results in Colorado, it seems that marijuana is becoming ever more, I don't know, acceptable in some circles, and apparently that is being realized in your polling as well.
Yeah, it really is. I mean, the support has grown over pretty substantially and consistently, you know, for the last 5 years that we've been polling this question, to the point of reaching 58%, which is close to that magic number of 60% that most people believe you need to be at in order to pass a ballot proposal in this state, because, you know, usually the pinnacle of support is the day you announce those kind of ballot proposals, and then it usually erodes after that. So you need to have at least that 20-point gap, 60 to 40, to start out with in order to survive on Election Day. But it's close to it. It could happen in 2018 if it makes it on the ballot. I think if there's a good campaign against it, probably could be defeated if they bring up some of those problems that you talked about in Colorado and other places.
Well, I mean, it's not just the driving fatalities and accidents and so forth. The number of homeless people in Colorado has increased dramatically. Now, that's not to say that Colorado residents suddenly became homeless because they got their hands on recreational marijuana, but it suggests in other studies that vagrants, if you will, drifters, show up in Colorado because, well, there's, you know, there's weed and so forth. So they just kind of drift to Colorado, collecting more of the, I don't know, the undercurrent of society, if you will. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. There's a lot of problems with this proposal that's out there. I mean, it allows anybody to grow 8 plants. So yeah, everybody can be their own supplier at this point in time. No restrictions on where those are. They're next to a school or next to a daycare center or anywhere else. I think, you know, if you're going to pass this kind of proposal in Michigan, I think you really need to get law enforcement on board, because they're about, you know, they're batting 100% or 1,000% on ballot proposals. You've never beaten law enforcement. They come out against something, they tend to be able to defeat it at this point in time. So you got to find something that they can live with. And, you know, one of the reasons they use for passing, you know, the marijuana law is that you can free up the cops who are now, you know, busting people who are smoking, though I don't know when's the last time we sent somebody to jail for smoking, but, you know, that's one of their reasons for supporting this. But you get other types of crime. You know, I noticed today in the paper the 263 medical marijuana shops in Detroit operating illegally that they're trying to shut down at this point in time. Those are the supporters. Those people who run those kind of shops are the same supporters who are supporting legalized marijuana.
Now, I can drive around Lansing and all sorts of places and see the Green Cross, you know, the which is the medical marijuana sign, all over the place. Are you telling me all of those shops are operating illegally as well?
I don't know, because, no, this is Detroit passed their own ordinance to license these shops, and none of these shops complied. I think now they're up to like 5 that actually have complied. So it depends if Lansing is playing with their own ordinance as well and trying to restrict it, because they just grow up. I mean, it seems like there's one on every street corner.
Well, yeah, that's true all over the place in driving around Michigan. It's almost as if, you know, it was passed, then it was rejected, then it was kind of put back in place. It's almost become commonplace. But it concerns me. I don't think it's good for overall. I don't think it's good for young people. I don't think it's good for people to be exposed to it at a tremendously young age and so forth. And do I believe it probably has some sort of relationship to the increase of car accidents and fatalities in Colorado? Probably. Does it have something to do with the increase of crime in Colorado? Probably. The homelessness? Probably. Is there a direct cause and effect? Well, I haven't been able to ascertain that yet, but the studies are only a couple of years old in Colorado, so, you know, $7.3 million worth of marijuana sold there in the first year. It continues to grow. I don't know where it goes. But if it was put on the ballot right now in Michigan, Tom, you think it might just pass?
It could. It could possibly. One group that they haven't been able to convince to pass it are anybody over 65. It seems like even with the baby boomers, you know, starting to infiltrate the 65 and older crowd, they have consistently opposed this thing. It seems like when you get to that age, you say, well, maybe this isn't a great idea. Only 34% of the people that are 65 and over support it at this point in time. Now, that's up from where it was, only by a few percentage points. It's been pretty consistent. So in a non-presidential year, those voters are key. They make up a huge block of of voters in a in a gubernatorial election, you're non-presidential, but the young voters don't come out and vote. I have heard that in Colorado they had a surge of younger voters under 25 going out to the polls when the proposal was on the ballot out there. So maybe that drives people out to vote here in Michigan. Who knows?
Yeah, I guess we're going to find out. You know, smoking is opposed everywhere in the world now, and unless you're smoking weed, which apparently it's okay. But cigarette smoking, you know, we're at the lowest point we've ever been in my lifetime. The number of people who smoke cigarettes in America down to, 17% and dropping. Smallest percentage ever. Tom Shields, greatly appreciate you bringing us up to speed on this. I guess we'll see what happens and if they decide to make a run at the ballot. Where can people find out more?
Yeah, that's where we have elections, you know. There's a proposal on the ballot. If there's a group on the ground trying to put it on the ballot, I think if you just do some Google searches, you can find out more. You can go to at mrgmichigan.com, and you can read a little bit more about our poll also.
There you go. Hey, Tom, I greatly appreciate it. Talk soon.
Thank you. Bye.
All right. Fix me something good to
The Steve Gruber Show, American Values with Midwestern Common Sense.
All right, welcome back to it. My next guest, Cliff Maloney, is the president of Young Americans for Liberty. It is the largest, most active, and fastest-growing pro-liberty organization on America's college campuses. There are more than 900 YAL chapters and over 300,000 activists nationwide. Let's find out more about what it is. Cliff, welcome to the program.
Hey, Steve. Thanks for having me today.
All right. So liberty is not something that fits on a lot of college campuses, as we hear on pretty much a daily basis. Free speech and free thought shall not be tolerated. In fact, I suggest we get the bulldozers out and start burning books, but who am I? Cliff, you're up against it. But I appreciate what you're doing. Tell us about the organization and what it stands for.
Yeah, absolutely, Steve. So the organization is put together. Really, we're built out on college campuses across the country with a simple mission statement to identify, educate, train, and mobilize youth activists committed to winning on principle. And that winning on principle is the key part. We're talking about limited government. We're talking about liberty. We're talking about the idea and constitutional principles that the country was founded on. And so we're out on campus. We've got over 900 chapters across the country that are advocating for these principles of freedom. And you bring up free speech. So let me dive right in and tell you about one of our biggest projects that's ongoing. And that is something called our National Fight for Free Speech campaign. And this is something that we set up because colleges, I don't think I have to tell you, they are not the most friendly places for conservative and libertarian students.
No,
so what's
really?
What's happened is they've created these different zones on campus, or these speech codes, as they call them. And what they're really doing is, you know, if Bernie's socialist group is out promoting a 90% tax rate, you know, nobody says anything. But if we're handing out the Constitution and advocating for freedom, our students are getting shut down. And so we've been out there, and we're working to get rid of these codes. And I'm pretty proud to say that we've actually gotten rid of over 25 of these, you know, so-called free speech zones.
Really? Tell me about some of your victories. Tell me about some of your big victories, because this is important, Cliff, that you're knocking this nonsense backwards. You don't need freedom of speech for happy talk. I mean, come on, geniuses. You don't need. Let's get with it. Go on.
Sure. So let's talk about some of our victories. So Wichita State, we were actually shut down because they said that Young Americans for Liberty and the Constitution was, quote, dangerous for students to hear. That was one of my favorite ones. Another one we had at Arkansas State, where a bureaucrat actually told our students that the free speech zone trumps the Constitution. Let me see here. I'll go local for you. So at Kellogg Community College in Battle Creek, Michigan,
yes,
we had one of the most egregious cases. It's an ongoing court battle right now. But what I will tell you is we had some student leaders that were handing out constitutions. And by the way, I mean, let's talk about a taxpayer-funded institution, a community college, which is supposed to uphold the Constitution.
You'd think.
They're passing out these pocket constitutions, and this bureaucrat approaches them and says, you need to go in the free speech zone. He said, sir, you know, we're just talking to our fellow students. We're handing out constitutions. They arrested the students put them in jail overnight, held them until about 7 or 8 in the morning. And right now, I mean, we filed a lawsuit, and we're going after them to get rid of the code and to do right by the students. But, I mean, it doesn't get more egregious than that, arresting a student for handing out pocket constitutions.
All right, when did this happen?
I hate to tell you this, but it's right in Michigan.
Yeah, when did this happen?
So this just happened in the fall, and the legal process has been ongoing. We had, let me put it this way, the case was filed earlier this spring, and just recently, last week, we filed an injunction, because what we're trying to do is, as the case is ongoing, we want them to immediately say, you know, right now, even while the case is going on, they need to get rid of that free speech zone. They cannot continue to abuse that, you know, and use that to shut down students that are promoting conservative and libertarian ideas on campus. So that's the injunction we're waiting on right now. But, I mean, this type of thing is happening a lot more frequently than people are noticing, and we're trying to really shine a light on that.
You know, what's interesting is that a lot of this stuff gets buried along the way. You know, they hide this stuff all the time. And, you know, the national news media, of course, won't report on this, but they'll report on, you know, Ann Coulter getting kicked out of Berkeley or whatever, and they'll spend 3 days and, you know, 27 hours of coverage on that. But students getting arrested for handing out pocket constitutions, yeah, that's not going to make the news. Nobody cares about that. Yeah, that's the problem, you see.
Yeah, you're 100% right. And that's why we've been out there. That's why we're, you know, leading this fight. And, you know, the funny thing is, it's not that we're looking for an advantage as conservative or libertarian students. We don't want an advantage. We just want a level playing field so that our ideas can be heard. And what I tell a lot of people is, you know, look, if Bernie comes to campus or somebody that's promoting the idea that, you know, pretty much we should be a socialist country, Young Americans for Liberty members are not going to burn the campus to the ground. We're not going to throw bricks through windows. We're not going to light couches on fire. What we're going to do is we're going to show up and we're going to peaceably have a conversation and show through intelligent thought that the ideas of limited government are the way forward. And that's something I'm really proud, you know, to say of our membership.
Well, clearly, the problem is you're going to need a lot more attorneys and a lot more help. I mean, obviously, unless you have your own legal arm, how are you going to get there?
Right. So we partner with two groups, Alliance Defending Freedom and Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, ADF and FIRE. They're both fantastic groups. They're kind of our legal arm. So our students are the ground troops, if you will, who are going out there. And we actually jokingly call it triggering the campus when we do an event and our students get shut down. And then ADF and FIRE, you know, work with us on cases. And they have been fantastic partners because they're the reason we're able to process these. And like I said, to go through, I mean, we've overturned 25 of these unconstitutional speech codes. And once again, not looking for an advantage for our students, but just looking, you know, to have the opportunity for a level playing field to talk about constitutional principles.
So, Cliff,
whoever knew how, you know, scandalous the Constitution could become?
Yeah, handicap this for me. Kellogg, well, the left has no use for the Constitution. You know that in today's day and age. They want to dictate what free speech is. And free speech is perfectly acceptable as long as you say exactly what they want you to say. Kellogg Community College, this case in Michigan, handicap your expectations. Are you going to win?
Oh, well, look, I'm supposed to lowball, right? I am very confident that we are going to be able to get rid and win that case and get rid of these unconstitutional speech codes. You know, I mean, these colleges, we have a 100% record so far. We have not lost when we go to litigation, and I'm pretty proud of that. But it's funny, you know, I'll tell you, Steve, a lot of times when we have an incident, we send a letter and they start quaking in their boots. Because, look, if you get in front of a judge and you say, hey, you know, you shut down students who are talking on campus and they're students on campus and you're a public university. I mean, most of the judges, as much as we've lost some of the, you know, parts of society when it comes to the rule of law, a lot of judges are still, you know, pretty in tune with the First Amendment. And so it's an interesting process. But when we actually go to court, you know, usually they're fairly quick and, you know, they're landing on the side of freedom, which is reassuring.
Well, I would hope so. But, you know, when I was growing up, I don't know how old you are, Cliff, but when I was growing up, people used to say, well, it's a free country, do what you want. I don't hear that anymore, to be honest with you. Anyhow, I'll give you the last word. You got 10 seconds.
All right. Head over to yaliberty.org. Check us out. If you're a student, Let's get involved and spread the Constitution. If you'd like to support us, we'd love your help. YatLiberty.org. Thanks so much, Steve.
Hey, I greatly appreciate it. I'm sure we'll talk soon, Cliff. Thank you very much.
All right, bye-bye now.
41 after. We'll be right back.
Covering Michigan and the world from his bunker below the bridge, here is Steve Gruber.
Here come the jesters, one, two, three. It's all part of my fantasy. I love the music and I love to see the crowd dancing in the aisles and singing out loud.
You know, it was a tough weekend. Tough weekend for Tiger Woods. Tough weekend. Picked up on a DUI. The 41-year-old legendary golfer picked up on a DUI. Releasing a statement here moments ago. I understand the severity of what I did, and I take full responsibility for my actions. So says the pro golfer. I want the public to know that alcohol was not involved. What happened was an unexpected reaction to prescribed medications. I didn't realize the mix of medications had affected me so strongly. I would like to apologize with all my heart to my family, friends, and the fans. I expect more of myself as well. He was arrested in Juniper, Florida, Monday, early in the morning. Taken into custody around 3 in the morning, released without bond just before 11. He shares two children, Sam, his son, and his daughter, Sam, excuse me, son Charlie, with ex-wife Ellen Nordegren, has had multiple back surgeries over the years. Last week, he wrote on his blog that his sole focus is rehab and doing what the doctors tell me. So I don't know what to make of this. The initial reports were that he was arrested for DUI, driving under the influence. So I guess it's time to figure out, sort this out. All right, let's get Tim Stout on the line, see if Tim can sort it out for us. He is the dean of sports, and just see if it's the drugs, is it alcohol? Tim, welcome to it.
Good morning, Steve. Morning.
A big crash for, not a big crash literally, but a big problem for Tiger Woods. He looks terrible in a smug shot. They always do. But here's a DUI arrest in Jupiter, Florida. What do you make of it from what you've read so far?
Well, for that much money, you'd think you'd have a driver to take you someplace and I don't know all the details, obviously, because this happened over the weekend, happened yesterday in the middle of the night. The times have been tough for him. Obviously, it's been not the year that he envisioned because he can't play, and he thought he was going to be able to play, and who knows when he's going to be able to play again. And without knowing, all the details of this, I see what he's making reference to the fact that he's, taking some, some kind of treatment for his condition and so on and so forth, and that was what the reaction was to. Whether there's any relevance to any of that, I don't know, remains to be seen. But if ever, some of those companies that sponsor him wanted to get out for any reason, this might give them the avenue, if that's what they so choose to do, just simply because he's not the glistening gem that he was 20 years ago for all those companies that wanted him to represent them. I don't know if there'll be any corporate fallout or not, but certainly, that's not the image that a lot of those companies who pay him a great deal of money want, let alone the fact that he's no longer a factor on the professional golf tour as it is and is rarely seen. And as you suggest, the only time you saw him was in a mugshot yesterday.
Correct. There was a time, and I remember this well, there was a time when Tiger Woods was first breaking on the scene. He had won his first major or second, and people were saying, well, Tiger Woods is the greatest golfer of all time. And a close friend of mine who's a sports writer and a golf guy said, he's a long way from 18 majors. Jack Nicklaus, of course, won 18 majors. And I think, if I'm not mistaken, Tiger Woods has won 11. So the greatest golfer of all time, Tiger Woods, probably not. What would you say?
Well, he's won 14, but he's been stuck since 2008. The way I've always answered this is the greatest career of all time was Nicklaus. The greatest year of all time was Woods in 2000 when he won everything in sight. But I think the difference between those two, frankly, is values and the way they were all raised. Nicklaus has always been an enormous family man, homebody, who was very, very, close to his wife and his parents and his kids. Not that Woods is not in some respects there, but, I don't think anybody ever said no to him when he was at the peak of his career. He did what he wanted, how he wanted, when he wanted, where he wanted. And frankly, I don't think it's a necessary coincidence that when he began to have those marital problems, that his injuries piled up and mounted up and began and went over and over and over. And I remember Nicklaus himself saying that as Woods got older, he would face distractions that every golfer faces. When you're young like Jordan Spieth is today, all you do is play golf and practice and go from one tournament to the next, and it's just golf, golf, golf. Then when you get older, you lose your focus a little bit. Other things come into your life. And certainly in Woods' case, other things have come into his life. I think his injuries are legitimate. But where he's going to go with the rest of his life, given the enormous amount of publicity and personality and persona that he's had through the years and where he is today, is an amazing fall. I liken it in some ways to Mike Tyson, who was on top of the boxing world and went straight downhill. He can't even enter any of the tournaments anymore, and who knows if that's ever going to change, given the fact that he's had four back surgeries. Whether any of this yesterday is related to any of his other problems or not, I guess we'll have to wait and see.
Yeah, I guess we'll find out. But, definitely a difficult time for him. We'll find out more as the stories come out. Tim Stout, always a pleasure. Thank you for the insight.
You're welcome, Steve.
There you have it. Tim Stout, everybody, the Dean of Sports. Will he ever make 18? A guy that I know well. Golfer, sports writer, said, yeah, he'll be the greatest as soon as he tops 18. And he's a long way from there, and he's certainly a long way from winning five majors now, isn't he, at the age of 41? All sorts of problems physically in his personal life. It's 52 after. It's the Steve Huber Show.